Life Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, Chairman and Founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity, flying the flag for integrative medicine on behalf of those with cancer for the last 17 years. In today's show, I'm welcoming back the very popular expert guest, Dr. Carol Granger. Dr. Granger is a biochemist and microbiologist who now practices nutritional medicine and who has a specialist interest in the microbiome. I'm speaking to Carol over the internet at her home in Sussex. Hi, Carol, a big welcome back to the Yes to Life Show.
It's so nice to join you again, Robin.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on again. We're going to be talking about a favourite topic of yours, the microbiome, but there is a lot to say on what is a very important and fast-developing topic. So, more and more people with cancer are becoming aware that the microbiome is something they should pay attention to, but like most things, it's not quite so simple. And I think it's prompting many people to be a bit anxious about, they've heard of probiotics and prebiotics, which ones should they be using, whether they should get tested all the time, how often, and you know, what it all means for their long-term health. So How do you generally respond to these concerns?
Well, I think they're obviously very justifiable concerns for people because it's an area that is very fast evolving. So there's new information coming out all of the time without a great deal of clarity a lot of the time. So it's something that's reached mainstream awareness. I mean, There's been a lot of talk about the microbiome and its influence on mental health, for example, as well as the influence on immunity. So I think it's one of those areas where there's a huge amount of noise and it's being able to pick out the signals from the background noise that can help people. And I understand why people would become anxious, because it's the sort of thing where people might feel that there are things that they should be doing specifically if they are concerned about cancer. So people that might have had a diagnosis of cancer, or they have a strong family history of cancer, or it's something that they are at risk of because they've got a precancerous condition. So I would hope that in our sort of bit of time together today that we can unravel some of these so that people feel a little bit more certain about what they can do that will be helpful and not feel guilty if there are areas that they feel they should have done, like having lots of testing done regularly. So I'd say it's kind of relaxing back a little bit and saying, well, there's some things that I can do that are fairly straightforward, but it's still an area of evolving evidence.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it, working in these situations, because the patient themselves has got possibly a quite drastic situation with a timeline to it, and yet the science is, as you say, it's only just emerging. And so you knowing exactly what you could rely on reasonably and what you can't is tricky.
Yeah, you're right, It is. So I'd say there's a couple of places to sort of start picking apart things and where we can take a little bit of a delve into the main areas of certainty and then look at what that might mean for people.
Okay.
Especially at this time of year where our food tastes are changing and there's the sort of, you know, going to parties and thinking about alcohol and whether or not they should have alcohol and what that might sort of do to the microbiome. So I think maybe one place to start is to say the whole of the topic about the microbiome really started when thinking about the gut. So people with stomach cancer, bowel cancer, other gastrointestinal cancers and so on might think, well, they are the people that should be concerned.
Right.
And that's really where it started in terms of the big areas of research. It's because we know that the gut has got the largest microbiome in the body.
Right.
But what it's now showing is that the influence of that gut microbiome is actually way beyond the gut. So it's more than just a concern. It's an area that people should be more aware of if they've got other cancers. And one area that I'm going to touch on today are two areas that are really quite a long way from the gut. One of them is breast, and talk about breast cancer. And the other one is mouth cancer and conditions in the mouth. So those sort of two areas are where the microbiome, they're actually physically quite a long way from your gut. But what goes on in there, what goes on in the gut has an implication for breast cancer. And what goes on in the mouth actually has an implication for cancers in other parts of the body. So, right. So those are the sort of two areas that, where we might sort of just have a look at some of the research that's coming out and see how that can be applied in sort of daily life.
Right. Good. Well, yes, I'm definitely keen to do that. I just wanted to just look a little bit further, because the thing you've brought to light in what you've just said is that, yeah, all the talk about the microbiome was thinking about the gut initially, but actually I think it's kind of spreading now, isn't it? The interest to, and realising that there are sort of mini microbiomes all over the place, which each have an effect on us in different ways.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. And they're generally called microbiome niches. So okay. There's a microbiome niche in the lungs, and, you know, quite deep into the lungs, actually. And what we know is that the microbiome in the lungs actually has an impact on lung health. Mm. And so, for example, people that have had to have a lot of antibiotics, and that might be for respiratory infections,
right.
Then that changes the microbiome in the lung. And that actually changes the immune conversations going on the surface of the lungs. So what we know is that the lungs should have some pretty healthy bacteria in there and not too many unhealthy bacteria. And if there's an imbalance in that, then that can be associated with inflammation, and that inflammation has an impact. And what we know from research into lung cancer is that it could be that the microbiome can be a very useful part of your immune system, and that's the lung microbiome. And of course, one question might be, well, how do we influence the lung microbiome?
Exactly.
You know, what can I do about it?
Yeah, good question. Well, what can we do?
What can we do about it? Well, there's been some interesting research recently, and I look through the research all the time, and of course, yes. I was a microbiologist for a long time, so I dip into those sort of theoretical journals, and some of this has come from laboratory research. So very little of it is done in humans, but it is worth looking at the fact that there have been a couple of recent studies where, using animal models, what they've shown is that having prebiotic foods in the diet actually increases the immune surveillance inside the lungs.
Mm.
So actually, by eating fairly straightforward foods, and dare I say, Brussels sprouts are wonderful prebiotics.
Excellent.
And we're all going to have lots of those in front of us.
One of my favourites, yeah.
Yeah, so it does seem that what you eat actually has an impact on the microbiome in different parts of the body.
Mm.
And the lung microbiome communicate. So all of these microbiome niches, like the one in the lungs, and in fact there's a microbiome in the breast, there's a microbiome in the vagina, there's microbiomes on the skin, mm-hmm. and they all communicate in various ways with the microbiome in the gut. And one way to think of it is that the microbiome in the gut is the mothership, if I can use that sort of space film analogy that the
yes.
sort of science fiction analogy, that the gut microbiome is a bit like the mothership that does actually communicate with other gut, with other microbiome niches, especially in the lungs and in the breast and in the pancreas and gallbladder. So what goes into the gut can actually be used. It's an indirect way of improving the lung microbiome, for example.
Right.
And so it's worth actually just bearing that in mind. And that means that if somebody has a condition that's affecting a distant organ, like mm-hmm. the lung, distant to the gut, that is, then it's not wasted to actually be working on your gut microbiome.
Understood.
That makes sense.
Can I just hop back? You said about all these microbiome niches communicating with the mothership. How? Anybody know how they communicate?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, because we still don't know all of this detail. But part of the story seems to be something called bacterial translocation. So in your gut, you've got a kilo of bacteria,
mm-hmm.
and lots of other things in there as well, some of which we don't even know what they are. So there's some viruses and there's probably some yeasts. But what we do know is that bacteria do seem to be able to move into the bloodstream, so through the lining of the intestine, some bacteria can move, and maybe not all of the bacteria, it might be just be part of it. So it might be small portions of something called endotoxin, which is on the outside of bacteria. And so you get that sort of movement of things from the gut, where from the mothership, going back to that analogy, and that can go out into various places via the bloodstream. There's also a degree of continuousness between, for example, the genital microbiome is obviously, you know, exactly connected, adjacent to the gut microbiome. So there's communication there, but part of it does seem to be through the bloodstream. So there's signalling through the bloodstream. And a very good example is there's some research going on at the moment into the microbiome in the breast, and especially in breast cancers. And some very good research is looking at the types of bacteria that are found in breast tissue that has been removed when somebody's gone for surgery after a diagnosis of breast cancer. And what they've identified is that there is movement of bacteria. There is this communication from, dare I call it, the mothership to the breast microbiome. And they're using some very fancy techniques to kind of fingerprint the DNA in the gut and to show that it's actually the same one that's appearing in the breast tissue. So it seems that the picture is that the place where most of the influence can be done is in the intestine, in the gut, and that's where diet really comes into it. But that it has an impact in other areas of the microbiome.
So I've got this picture of two extraordinary systems side by side. So one of them is your own system of cells, which somehow they are all communicating with each other and acting as a whole for the good of the whole. And then you have this colony of bacteria, massive colony of bacteria sort of living in and on us, which also seem to communicate together and act as a whole to a certain degree. How about the interface between the two?
Well, the interface between the two, there's a couple of ways that they interface. Firstly, the presence of some bacteria in the gut stimulates very specific reactions from white blood cells, particular populations of white blood cells. And so when they see, so for example, the blood in the blood vessels in the intestine, when they see certain bacteria in the gut, then that triggers them to release chemicals that activate other cells to come to their aid, or sends messages out to other parts of the immune system. And we know, for example, that there's signaling between the bone marrow, which of course is, you know, deep in bones, signaling between the bone marrow and the gut bacteria. So the interface seems to be, a lot of it's in the gut, and there are messenger cells that go between the gut and the other parts of the body. And as I say, it is an evolving picture. So there's probably other things that we're not completely aware of, but that does seem to be a big part of the exchange. And one way to think of it is that the gut microbiome is a bit like a boot camp for the immunity. And so if you can imagine, if anybody's ever been to a boot camp to try and get fit, or they've watched a TV program about people that do these boot camps, it gives them a really super workout. And so a really healthy microbiome can be a fantastic boot camp for the immunity by stimulating the certain populations of white blood cells to be switched on, to be ready for action. Not just for surveillance against malignant cells, but actually for surveillance against infections as well, including COVID.
Right. I was thinking of COVID when you started talking about the lungs and the microbiome in there. I was thinking, well, yeah, we have all these microbes in our stomach, which to help us deal with ingested toxins. And presumably there are things to help deal with infections that we breathe in then in this microbiome in the lung.
Well, in your lungs, you have various good bacteria lying in your lungs. They're kind of living in the mucus there, and they stimulate an immune reaction. They stimulate the release of a very useful little antibody called secretory IgA, which is a, sort of like a first line of defense. And that's actually found on all moist surfaces in the body. So it's found in the mouth and the airway and the stomach, and all moist surfaces in the area, in the body have secretory IgA, and different bacteria and in fact yeasts stimulate more of that secretory IgA, and it kind of acts as a first line defense.
So this is the synergistic action between the two, which we're benefiting from. Hence the name good bacteria.
Yes, and that's a really interesting one, because when you say, when we talk about good bacteria, we know that there are some that are nearly always good, and that it's good to have some of them, good to have quite a lot of them. And then there are some that we know cause mischief. And there's one or two species that keep coming up as a kind of a smoking gun with regard to lots of different cancers. And one of them is actually called Fusobacterium nucleatum. And that's found in deep pockets in the mouth in people with periodontal disease. And what we know is that if people have that bacterium in the mouth, then there's an increased likelihood that they also have that in pockets in the intestine, and particularly in some parts of the bowel. And that's actually associated with inflammation in the bowel and a greater risk of cancers in the gastrointestinal tract. So we know that there are some that are, you know, prime suspects for causing mischief. But the whole picture about microbes is that we actually don't know what all of them are. There's lots that have never been identified before. But we know that there are one or two that are probably very good species that we could all do with having some. And those are things like bifidobacteria. And a really good place to get bifidobacteria from is yogurt or kefir or sauerkraut. So the sort of fermented foods, it's a good place to get bifidobacteria.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
How good are vitamin C supplements? Usually only a small proportion of vitamin C actually reaches your cells and has a positive effect. Whereas the high absorption levels of Goldman Laboratories' liposomal vitamin C help maintain optimal vitamin C levels in your body and strengthen your immune system. Now get 10% off when you choose Goldman Laboratories' liposomal vitamin C capsules. Just quote 10 off at goldmanlaboratories.com.
Do you suffer from pain? B-Cure Laser, a home-use CE-approved medical device for the effective treatment of pain, is now available in the UK. The results of a double-blind trial has shown that B-Cure Laser offers a significant reduction in pain compared to the placebo group. To get your special B-Cure offer now, call free on 0808 501 5122 or Google Radio Pro London. B-Cure Laser. B-Cure Laser.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, well, it's good to know we can do positive things to improve the situation, isn't it? Because there are plenty of things in our environment and the way we live these days which are not that good for our good bugs. That's the case, isn't it?
Yes, that is the case. And, you know, if we think about putting food to one side for a moment, because obviously that's something that we have control over, then there are other things that we're exposed to that we probably can't do much about. I mean, there's potentially an impact from atmospheric pollution on lung health, and that may also have an impact on the lung microbiome. And using things like microbicides, we know that, of course, we all want to be washing our hands now to be careful about COVID, but sort of lifelong use of antimicrobial cleaners, for example, antimicrobial, you know, household chemicals, that's actually linked to a depletion of the microbiome in people, and is linked to more allergies in children. And that's potentially because they're not exposed to enough of the good bugs that are part of the boot camp I mentioned earlier that help their immune system to work properly. Mm. So there are lots of things that we don't have much control over in terms of the microbiome, but the biggest area of control that we have is what we put in our mouths, is what we eat, really.
Right, right. But it's been quite a major publicity task to change the image of bacteria, hasn't it? Because, you know, when I was growing up, they were just things you wanted to kill. That's all you knew about bacteria. They were just bugs you wanted to get rid of. And so any amount of chemicals were justified in order to do this. And so to actually turn that around 180 degrees and to realise that they're essential to our well-being is quite a quite a call, and I don't know it's really sunk in yet to society as a whole.
That's a very good point, because of course at the moment the messages that we're getting are that we have to be careful about passing viruses between, you know, to other people. So, you know, putting aside what we need to do for COVID, which is the antimicrobial hand washers or antiviral hand washers, and so on, then there are still lots of things that we can do to nurture our good microbes and to guard against overuse. So just to sort of think about one area is that if you are thinking about eating cultured foods, then they're really good for you. For most people, they can have cultured foods, that's yogurt and that sort of thing, then they're really useful for you. But there are a few people who obviously can't have those because they're in the middle of cancer treatment and they're immunocompromised. So there are a few people who really have to be much more careful about microbes because of the treatment that they're in at the moment, or because they've had a transplant, like a stem cell transplant, for example. But on the whole, we don't need to be paranoid about bacteria in on foods, obviously, you know, within reason. You wouldn't eat something that was knowingly contaminated. But a good sort of dose over our lifetime of lots of beneficial bacteria is good.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, they have done studies where they show that actually children who grow up in a kind of rural scenario, which is where they're exposed to many more bugs, actually have better immune systems as a result.
Yes, that's right. And they've looked at children growing up in households with pets and children growing up on farms and shown that. So there was something I just wanted to sort of go back to, which is about this question about breast cancer and the gut microbiome.
Yes, please.
Because, well, there's another link, actually. And so what we know is that there's lots of different types of breast cancer, but numerically, the largest number of diagnoses of breast cancer in the developed world, in the industrialised world, is actually of those that are hormone-driven.
Right.
And in the popular, if you look at the number of women that are diagnosed with breast cancer, that number is unfortunately rising. And a strong theme is estrogen as a driver of it. And we know that numerically that's the case. Now, when you look at younger women, that isn't necessarily the case. But when we look at women sort of postmenopausal, then most of those cancers are driven by estrogen.
Okay.
And there is actually a link between the microbiome and estrogen. And this is an area that is again, it's something that we can do something about. Because estrogen, just to kind of a very brief talk through of what happens with estrogen in the body, is that estrogen is made either by the ovaries or postmenopause, it's made by fatty tissue, by the adrenals and fatty tissue. And that estrogen circulates around the body and then it has to be disposed of. And it's disposed of, first of all, passage through the liver, and then the liver actually exports what's left of it, what are called estrogen metabolites, into the gut.
Okay.
And they should then go out. They go out in the stool. But what we know happens is that quite a large amount of that estrogen can actually be reabsorbed.
Right.
And it can be reabsorbed more if you've got an imbalance in the population of bacteria in the gut. And there's been some really elegant research looking at the metabolism of estrogen and how estrogen, you can export your estrogen more efficiently and get rid of it, which is what you want to do. You don't want it to be building up. You want to get rid of it effectively. And there is a link between dietary intake and gut microbes and estrogen metabolism, which is this process of eliminating effectively the estrogen that's circulating around. And just to give a couple of examples, if somebody has a high intake of saturated fats and a low intake of fiber, and that might be a characteristic of many diets in the industrialized world, mm-hmm. then what happens is that that estrogen is actually more likely to be reabsorbed. So you end up with higher level of particularly one type of estrogen metabolite in your bloodstream, and that isn't a good thing.
Mm. Sorry, yeah. Can I just jump in? And I just want to understand what's going on there. So there seem to be two things you talked about. One is the diet you're having, which obviously influences the microbiome anyway, but the diet itself could have an effect on whether it carries the estrogen through or not. And the other thing is the microbiome itself and its ability to transport the estrogen out of the system. I don't quite understand how either are working or which is predominant.
Okay. Okay. Well, they actually work together. So, okay. So one of the things that needs to happen for the estrogen to get reabsorbed is for a particular enzyme to be active in the gut. Oh. And that enzyme basically snips a marker off the estrogen so that the estrogen is reabsorbed.
Right.
So in that process of estrogen metabolism, what happens is it gets tagged for disposal. So a little tag is put on it that says, right, this is on its way out, we don't want
right.
it back.
Okay.
And then that estrogen metabolite with a marker on it that says, okay, this is for disposal, that goes into the bowel and then out it should go. Mm. But if you've got certain bacteria present in the bowel or in the intestine, then they're going to snip that marker off that says this is for disposal and it will get reabsorbed again. So it's a combination. It's the action of the bacteria. It's actually it's an enzyme called beta-glucuronidase that does this job of snipping off that marker that says this is for disposal.
Mm. So, you don't want
so
that.
If you have... Yeah, so that's the kind of link, really. And so it's one of those situations, of it's almost a perfect storm. If you have a lot of saturated fat in the gut mm-hmm. that's from the diet, and you don't have very much fibre in the gut, then that's going to increase the rate at which this can happen, particularly if you've got some bacteria there that produce this beta-glucuronidase enzyme in large amounts. Now, it's a balance because we need that enzyme, we need some activity of it, and we need some saturated fat in our diet, but it's all about balance. And so if somebody could manage to reduce their saturated fat intake and increase their fiber, then that tends to tip things into a more healthy picture so that they excrete more of their estrogen.
Right. Well, isn't that interesting? So... all of that, we have to remind ourselves, came from talking about breast cancer. So interestingly, you basically linked up a balanced diet, which includes a decent amount of fibre, with a sort of propensity for build-up of oestrogen and therefore danger of breast cancer or other hormone-driven cancers, presumably.
Yes, exactly. And you made a good point there that it's not the entire picture. It's only part of the picture.
Yeah.
And what we know is that the way that estrogen is broken down does have quite a considerable genetic component to it.
Right.
And there are other nutrients that are needed as well. But if you had somebody that has a sort of adverse configuration of enzymes that break down estrogen so that they're already producing more of an unfavorable type, and then they've got the distortion in their gut microbes and they've got the diet that is not favorable, then that all adds up to risk. And it builds a picture why some types of cancer are more common in
right.
some populations. And linked to diet as well. So it's a complex picture, but I think a couple of take-home messages from it is that certainly having more fibre in your diet is better because it tends to support a better balance of microbes.
Right.
And being sparing on the particularly saturated animal fat then that also helps to have a more favourable balance of microbes.
Interesting. As with everything, the body seems to have massive numbers of the lines of defence, but if you compromise too many of them, you're in trouble.
Yeah. And there is very good research looking at this. So it sounds like a sort of complex picture that doesn't have too many real facts in it, but there is actually a lot of research on this whole picture of estrogen metabolism and how estrogen metabolism is influenced by dietary intake and gut microbes. So it's underpinned by a lot of laboratory research and also observations from women with different diagnoses and looking at their actual microbial pictures.
Yeah. Well, you know, given what you said at the beginning about the fact that, breast cancer is massive, the amount of it around, and this hormone-driven ones are the larger part of it, we should pay attention to anything that looks like it could be involved with creating this situation.
Well, that's a good point. And one of the things I'm always aware of is that breast cancer is very well researched. It's of all the cancers, probably attracts more research funding.
Yeah.
Prostate cancer is, of course, the most common cancer affecting men in the developed world. It's another hormone-driven cancer. And just recently, somebody has documented the fact that in men who have cancer that's become resistant to the main line of treatment, so men with prostate cancer that's become resistant to the androgen blocking therapies, that's the drugs that block testosterone, that there could be other things going on there. What we know is that if you block, for most men diagnosed with prostate cancer, if you block the testosterone pathway at some point with drugs like abiraterone and bicalutamide and so on, then that cuts off the main driver for prostate cancer. But some men seem to become resistant to that type of treatment. And it could be that there were other things definitely going on. There were other drivers of those cancers. But just very recently, somebody's documented the fact that gut bacteria seem to be able to produce androgens, which are that's the group of hormones that testosterone is part of.
Mm-hmm.
That it seems that there are some species of gut bacteria that are producing androgens, and that might be, so it could be that you're giving somebody a drug that blocks their own testosterone, but at the same time there's some microbes in their gut that are actually producing that producing testosterone or testosterone like compounds, and that's very recently been documented.
Interesting.
So, and again, it kind of points to the fact that all roads lead to the gut, as it were.
Oh, fascinating. I mean, imagine if there's nothing wrong with your own level of testosterone, but it's actually all coming from what's going on in your gut, and you didn't address that. It's obviously very important to find out more about.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Galar Light is the quantum energy emitted from the universe, from the sun and stars. Now, Tom Palladino, a humanitarian and Scalar Light researcher, has created the world's only Scalar Light healing system, a system that can bring long-distance healing and wellness to humans, pets, and plants via a photograph. Get your free 15-day trial now at scalarlight.com. Or click on the Scalar Light banner on the UK Health Radio website.
Shields like masks are top of mind right now. But did you know you have inner armor working constantly to protect you from pathogens? It keeps you healthy and thriving. It's your immune system. Ion Gut triggers the body's natural ability to support gut strength all year long, so your immune system can protect you when you need it the most. How are you treating your inner armor? Visit uk.ionbiome.com to learn more. Ion Gut. Protect what protects you.
UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
But nonetheless, given that there's a possibility, if you were somebody who had prostate cancer now, there'd be no harm in taking some steps to improve your microbiome anyway.
Yes, that's really a very good take-home message, Robin, because wherever the cancer is in the body, the one thing that you want to harness to help you is your own immune system. Mm-hmm. And so we know that the immune system tends to work better against the backdrop of these healthy gut bacteria. So it goes back to this boot camp concept, that the idea is that if you've got a healthy microbiome in your intestine, that's going to be a nice boot camp for your immune system.
Right.
And so whatever health complaint somebody has, they can always do better if their immune system is working well.
Yeah.
And so it's what can people do about it is obviously a big question. So even though the science hasn't, by any means, science hasn't given us all the answers, there's still a very long way to go with regard to how the immune system is activated by the microbiome.
Right.
But the sort of the general trend is that when you look at people that don't have diseases, that live long and have, you know, have health into older age, they tend to have a very varied microbiome with lots of different species in there, and a few very important species. I mentioned earlier about Bifidobacterium, that's one. And that seems to be a marker for a balanced microbiome, which helps the immune system to work well.
Amazing. It's just one of those things where it's always the right answer. That's the thing about it. Having a good gut bacteria is always the right answer, regardless of, whether, for instance, it was affecting your testosterone levels or not. There's still no reason not to do it, is there?
Exactly. And actually, some of the newest treatments that are being used now for people with a cancer diagnosis, the treatments like immunotherapy and targeted treatments, things like the TKIs, the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, there's a really considerable amount of evidence now that particularly immunotherapy seems to interact with the gut microbes. And that's been very well studied. There's lots of people have looked at that. And if anybody wants to spend a bit of time reading a very accessible paper, if they look up Professor Tim Spector, who's at King's College in London,
right,
his group have done a lot of research on the microbiome. And particularly, he's put together a really good review last year about the interactions between cancer treatments and the immune system and the gut microbiome. So for people who are going on to treatment now, then it's worth making sure that it's worth taking steps to look after their microbiome, whatever kind of treatment they're on.
Right.
And obviously, you know, for each individual, there are risks as well. But I'd say that it's definitely worth looking at.
Mm. So sort of coming back to where we started about the fact that things are not necessarily as simple as we'd like.
Yeah.
In terms of people who have cancer or who are going through treatment particularly, decisions on what to do to keep your microbiome in a good state are not necessarily completely straightforward, are they? And are people really advised to have an expert on hand to help them decide what to do?
Well, that's one way to do it, yes, of course. I mean, they can talk to, you know, they can first of all discuss it with their clinical team, but if they want further advice, then obviously it's useful then to talk to somebody that is qualified in this and is used to giving advice on it. I'd say that for some people, there are some areas just to be aware of. Thinking about people that are very immunocompromised, people having chemotherapy, for example, then they have to be very careful about large intakes of live bacteria from probiotic supplements. And so for most people, having live bacteria in the form of food is safe, unless you're extremely compromised.
Okay.
And so obviously the first thing is listen to your clinical team. And if they tell you that you're severely neutropenic, that would mean that your neutrophils are very, very low, and therefore you shouldn't be loading up with supplements of probiotics and so on. And you should probably also be very careful about live foods.
Yeah.
And so firstly, listen to your clinical team and see what they say. But for people that are not neutropenic, then there are lots of ways of getting good bacteria into the system. And the first way is really through food, is through cultured food. So that's, you know, so-called fermented foods and live foods, yogurt, kefir, sauerkraut, kimchi, even cider vinegar. So making a salad dressing with a nice live cider vinegar and some olive oil, that's a good way of doing it. So, and they're all pretty safe foods. They're pretty accessible as well for most people.
Yeah. So I'm imagining that foods, as food does everywhere when it comes to nutrition, it gives you a really nice mix and balance of bacteria, which you're unlikely to get by taking made-up supplements.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it, actually, because when you, for example, if you have some kefir or you have yogurt, then you're getting different cultures. And the important thing is that some of those species are sort of vanguard species, that if you get those into your gut, they will actually nurture the growth of some others alongside them. Because we know that bacteria in the microbiome actually live in communities. I mean, they communicate with each other, they swap metabolites with each other. So they don't sort of live in little isolated pockets. There are groups of them that work in unconscious synergy. I mean, I don't want people to imagine that they've got conscious minds that they're thinking, you know, should I link with that other bacteria? It doesn't work that way. It's actually a biochemical communication between them, and they've evolved to live alongside other species and to prefer some than others. And so if you eat certain species, then they tend to help the growth of others alongside them. And that's very helpful. So yes, cultured foods are a really good place to start. It doesn't mean to say that probiotics aren't suitable, but I would always say, you know, cultured foods is a good place to start, and that's safe for pretty much everybody unless they're severely neutropenic.
Yeah, okay. So we're coming towards the end, and we're also coming towards Christmas, which is a time when people's normal eating habits and so on tend to change rather drastically for a short period. How about a few handy Xmas hints on how to manage the microbiome over Christmas?
Okay, that's that. I'm glad you got round to that bit, because the most important thing about what you do for your microbiome is what you eat. And so I just talked about how you can get good microbes from cultured foods. They're so-called probiotic foods. But really the most powerful thing you can do are the things that feed those microbes, and they're called prebiotics. And amongst prebiotic foods are things that you could put on your dinner table, put on your Christmas lunch table, things like butternut squash. So think about having some roasted butternut squash alongside your roasted potatoes, because butternut squash and pumpkin is a really good prebiotic. Brussels sprouts are a good prebiotic as well. Mushrooms are great. So if you're thinking about making a nice stuffing, or if you're having a vegetarian Christmas and you're thinking about making a nut roast or a nut crown or something like that, then think about putting mushrooms in, because mushrooms are really superb prebiotic. So amongst your sort of choice of vegetables, there's a few things that you can put in that are positively beneficial. And basically all vegetables are prebiotic to some extent, but some are much more powerful than others. So that's a sort of good way. And then what you might think about doing, if you're thinking about your pudding, maybe if you're having a piece of Christmas pudding, then you might think about having it with some live Greek yogurt rather than cream. So that's a good way of adding just a few foods onto your Christmas table. It doesn't mean to say that you shouldn't have some nice treats as well, but it just means think about what you can put onto your plate that would nurture your good bacteria or give you some good bacteria.
And what's the take-home message on the alcohol?
Well, alcohol, a lot of alcohol actually depletes the microbiome. Some alcohol actually carries some good microbes in it. So I'm not recommending one brand or another, but actually things like proper craft beers, then they are made with barley or something like that, which is that's a prebiotic. So a small glass of stout, that might go down well.
Right.
But the thing with alcohol is that too much alcohol, and particularly regular alcohol, actually depletes the microbiome.
Right.
So it's all about moderation. But of course, it's a time of year to enjoy yourself. Hmm. So, but in moderation.
Excellent. Well, you've just maybe put a bit of biology behind the stout having a reputation as a kind of sort of healthy, fortifying drink, haven't you? Interesting. Yes. Anyway, look, it's been fascinating to talk today. I have learned a lot today, Carol. Thank you very much. Really interesting stuff. There's so much, isn't there, to talk about with the microbiome. I feel like we could go on and on. But thanks very much. All your expertise is fantastic. You've answered every question I've asked you. And I was quite expecting you to say, well, nobody knows with a lot of things, but it's amazing what is known already.
Yeah, that's really good. And it's so nice to be able to sort of share this knowledge with people, particularly because the knowledge is increasing all the time. So yeah. Thank you so much for inviting me to be interviewed today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much,
Take
Carol.
Take care. Bye.
The human body is such an extraordinary thing, and the more you find out about it, the more you realise that we really understand very little about its workings. Anyway, the take-home message today is clear. Respect the microbiome, as it's a hugely important aspect of your well-being. So glad you've been able to join me today. Do please make a note to listen again next week when I'll be back with another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye. Thank you.